This podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers, sponsors of Great Conversation. Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast, online editor. This week, we'll be discussing whether the right is tearing itself apart, why next week's elections have been forgotten, and whether books can be a force for evil. First up, has the right gone wrong? Donald Trump this week made a clean sweep of five more American states. And here's what he had to say.
I use the analogy of the boxer. You know, when the boxer knocks out the other boxer, you don't have to wait around for a decision. So that's what it is. And that's what happened tonight. That's what happened last week in New York. And that's really what's been happening throughout.
So what's powering his success? Freddie Gray argues in his Spectator cover piece that crazy is all the rage in today's politics and that the anti-politics mood is spreading. In France, in Germany, even here in Britain with our Brexit debate, conservatives are all going a little bit mad. Freddie joins me now with Tom Slater from Spiked magazine. So Freddie, why is crazy all the rage right now?
Well, I think we've known for a while that the left is going bananas. And I think a lot of conservatives, particularly in this country, have been very smug about Jeremy Corbyn and the sort of wildness of the left and the fact that sort of the Blairite model has completely failed. But what they haven't noticed is that actually on the right, the same thing's been going on. And in fact, the Blairite atom has split left and right, and that the British Conservative Party, now with the referendum, is starting to look just as crazy as, say, the Republican Party with Donald Trump.
Is there a creed behind any of this? Do they actually care about anything, or is it just a reaction?
Well, that's the funny thing. I think particularly among young people and on the internet, you see this phenomenon called the alt-right. It's very nihilistic. It's really, it doesn't want to stand for anything. It just wants to take the mickey out of everything and to just troll, to really just annoy people. That's what the right seems to want to do more than anything.
Tom, do you think this is a natural reaction to political correctness?
I think that's definitely plays a huge role. And it was fascinating reading Freddie's piece coming from Spiked, who'd been trying to work out what's gone wrong with the left for 15 years, kind of felt a pang of solidarity. I think particularly with something like the Trump phenomenon, I do have a certain sympathy with these supporters. I was over in the US a couple of weeks ago covering the election for Spiked and talking to them, you get a very clear sense that what's motoring them is not some sort of unreconstructed racism. It's not this sort of vitriolic bigotry, although I'm sure that plays a factor for some of them. It's the sense in which they feel that for a very long time, politicians have either ignored them or smeared them when it comes particularly around issues around immigration, social issues, etc. And one thing that's been really coming out, I think, over the course of the campaign cycle has been the fact that this is a kind of left-right phenomenon in terms of this trying to jettisoning of the public. You have the left, which is disgusted by these people, and you have the right that is kind of embarrassed by them. And I think that's something which really needs to be taken up. And I welcome it to the extent that I feel like it's busting through this very narrow consensus that we've had for a very long time. But, and I think this is something we really need to reckon with, is the fact that this reaction is reactionary in the purest sense of the word. It's authoritarian in so many ways. It's very anti-freedom and illiberal. And also, I think, as Freddie picks up in the piece, in terms of this new alt-right, it's actually really only the mirror image of a lot of the political correctness that it stands to set itself against.
I mean, you say it's anti-freedom, but isn't the whole argument that they're pro-freedom?
Well, yes, but I think Tom's right to say it's reactionary, and that conservatism, when it's good or when it works, is about sort of adapting to change and sort of moving with change in a way that slows it down. Whereas the reactionary mindset, particularly among the sort of crazies on the internet, is very much, we don't like this, let's destroy it and let's make it look as ridiculous as possible and laugh. And that's sort of fundamentally unconservative. It's fundamentally quite a sort of left-wing way of looking at the world.
You talk about this balance between kind of international globalization and nationalism. Which one do you think is the kind of stronger force?
Well, this is the big tension, I think, in the world at the moment, is between internationalism and nationalism. And the left, I think, has a kind of, although it has many problems with it, has a sort of vocabulary for, you know, when it talks about minority rights and social justice, has a vocabulary that can deal with the downsides of globalization. Whereas the right, because it loves the creative destruction of international capitalism, is divided because it also loves tradition and country. So the right hasn't really come up with an adequate response to globalization.
I suppose also it's slightly relying on globalization to spread its cause. Like Farage is now saying that he wants UKIP to become a kind of internet phenomenon after the referendum.
Well, it's technology. I mean, technology is speeding up the way these reactions happen.
And Tom, Freddie says that people are tired of being told what to think. Do you think that's the case in Britain?
I think that's definitely the case. And you can see it in terms of across, you know, Europe, in terms of this new rise of populism, of people who are looking to strike out against the political establishment. I think this is a combination of not only are their views being kind of ignored and smeared, but also the fact that there being a shocking amount, lack rather, of substance in politics, seemingly. And I think, therefore, in those sorts of situations, when it's difficult to tell politicians out from one another, you look for someone who at least has the appearance of clarity clarity and conviction. I think that actually plays a certain type of a role. But I completely agree with Freddie on the terms in which this is actually, to some extent, becoming a bit of an anti-freedom backlash, particularly on the internet. Because I think this response to political correctness actually imbibes a lot of the things which underpin political correctness, one of which being this kind of victimhood complex, which seems to be as potent now on the alt-right as it is on in terms of these blue-haired lefty nutters on the internet. And one thing you see that in terms of is, again, if it's something around, say, a Trump rally which gets disrupted, these people aren't protesters, they're thugs. And also this kind of very bad faith tendency to, rather than just critique political correctness, critique the positions of these people, to shame them, to slur them, to call them SJWs, and to just kind of occupy these mad, misogynistic, slightly racist positions for the sake of just having a bit of a laugh about it. But I think the thing that really needs to be underlined here is the fact that this is really born out of the collapse of the old politics. You've got a left which has shorn so many of its original principles in terms of freedom, in terms of liberation, democracy, growth, and you've got a right that feels like it's kind of lost its balls to some extent. And so I think a lot of these people, whether they're on the internet, whether they're protesting outside of a Trump rally or whatever, they're just kind of playing in the rubble left from what was originally substantial politics.
And Freddie, you mentioned Boris, and a cynic would say that he's just looked at what's going on with Trump and has decided to copy it. Do you think people will actually be convinced that he's anti-establishment?
I suppose it's a bit more of a joke, that this idea that Boris is doing sort of eloquent Trump now. And I don't want to be too unfair on Boris, because I don't think he's a sort of a Donald Trump type figure. But I do think the Vote Leave campaign knows deep down that to win, they have to appeal to this very sort of angry anti-establishment, anti-government mood.
You think people in Britain are as angry as they are in America?
So maybe not quite as much. But I do think that, and through the internet, and particularly with the young people and on groups like alt-right, there is a sort of tendency in which the purpose of conservatism was always to stand athwart history shouting stop, whereas for these guys, the purpose of conservatism is to stand athwart history shouting screw you.
Well, I think that's exactly the point, is that really at the moment there's just no proper alternative. And you see this in terms of someone like Donald Trump. This man doesn't really stand for anything. And I think that really points to the limits of this in terms of actual on-the-ground politics, the limits of this populism, insofar as it's not really offering any sort of real alternative outside of some genuinely extreme types on the continent who you really do know what they stand for, and it's actually pretty terrifying. And I think it's also the fact that we really now, what needs to happen is that we need a proper critique of this kind of authoritarian policing of the consensus, this political correctness. We need to show it for how liberal it is, but we also need to get back to the position of advocating what we do want society to look like. Because this kind of brattiness, this kind of battle of the snowflakes that you're seeing on the internet and elsewhere, and this kind of insubstantial populism that's really taking Western Europe and America by force, is really just covering up for the fact that whilst the old order has kind of collapsed, there's nothing yet that has come to take its place. And I think that alongside criticising these people, and alongside furthering a proper critique of political correctness and where our politics has gone wrong, we need to get back to the business of putting out a convincing vision for what we do want society to look like, so that we can stop just playing in the rubble.
And Freddie, you talk about conservatism having a nervous breakdown. How do you think this looks to China and India, this crisis of confidence that we're having?
Well, I think to Russia, particularly the Russian propaganda machine through Russia Today is very keen on heightening all the contradictions in the West and making conservative, social conservatives feel like their country is dying. And of course, we're proving them right by actually letting our political crisis go mad.
If Hillary comes to power, do you think it's going to die away?
No, I think if you think Americans are angry now, just wait for 4 more years of Hillary. They'll be completely frothing.
No, I think that's exactly the point. I mean, the most interesting thing about the American race at the moment is that, as kind of dynamic as it has felt and as interesting as it's been, the two front-runner candidates are more disliked on either side than anyone in really history. That's a particularly interesting moment where neither candidate have really any sort of positives, really, in terms of the politics and the public at large.
Well, yeah, and if you listen to the crazies, you know, the reason Donald Trump is running is because he's the only person in the world that could get Hillary elected.
Exactly. And I think that's just something which, again, sort of points to the fact that this is something we should take seriously, but it's not coherent necessarily. And it really should be seen as an opportunity to really make a case for what, whether you're on the left or whether you're on the right, what is important and what should happen. Because really, at the moment, that's what's been lacking, I think.
Next, the news you're not hearing. Wales, Scotland, London and many parts of England are going to the polls next week. But James Forsyth says that no one cares. Yet, is it only the question of Brexit which has taken our attention away? James joins me now with our editor, Fraser Nelson. So James, why have next week's elections failed to attract much interest?
I think the principal reason is the EU referendum that is dominating both the political and the media agenda. But I think it's also something else, which is Scottish politics is now so distinct from Westminster politics and politics south of the border, but there's not, people don't think there's that much can be learned from what happens there for what that means for British politics. In London, this is the first election without Ken Livingstone on the ballot. You know, with neither Boris Johnson nor Ken Livingstone, you know, you haven't got the same kind of national interest in the London contest that you had 4 years ago. But I think there's also something else, which is the devolution settlement has kind of frayed people's levels of interest in politics in other bits of the UK.
Fraser James says in his piece that we're more interested in American politics than Scottish politics. Why is that?
It's simply because devolution has made Scotland a place far further away. I mean, I found this for myself when I used to be the Scottish correspondent at the Times, and at the time I thought, this is a great job, I'm going to move into politics. And then I found out almost nothing I wrote would make the main issue with the Times. They called it the tartan spike. Spike is a journalistic word for a story that doesn't go in the paper. Because the decision was making that the people in England had no interest at all in what was happening in Scotland. You would know more about the politics of local politics of France than you would of a Scottish Parliament. And I was always amazed at the level of ignorance, actually, amongst people who seemed to think that Brigadoon was a documentary, you know, that Scotland really was a place of fairies and trolls and seaweed and things. And it was a problem which has been made worse by devolution, because we used to have a national media where a problem in Inverness would be reported down in London, and now devolution has led to devolved media where you've led to English only stories. And Newsnight, for example, people who watch it in England wouldn't know there's a Scottish opt out where the Scots can go and talk about their things. As a result, Scottish issues aren't raised in Newsnight itself. So devolution has made the media more fragmented, it's made our politics more fragmented, and it served to make us more of a divided rather than a united kingdom. This is one of the regrettable errors, I think, behind the whole devolution settlement.
And do you think we should be concerned about what's about to happen if the SNP do gain more power?
Of course. I mean, I'm always amazed to hear people in London talk about insurgencies, as political insurgencies, as being something that happens in the rednecked America or strange parts of France, where there is an insurgency right here in Britain going on in Scotland, where the SNP is about to yet again take the majority of seats. And it's going to have, I mean, you know, the phrase one-party state isn't quite true, because, of course, you do get quite a plurality of views. But the SNP is running the government, all the committees in the parliament, doing pretty much what it wants with a minimum of scrutiny. I'll give you one example. The education policy, I think, is awful. If you look at the attainment gap between rich and poor, is bad and growing. If you're poor and Scottish, you're half as likely to get to university as if you're poor in English. And yet, these problems aren't properly examined, either by the Scottish Parliament where the SNP dominates, or by weakening Scottish media, where there's only now one education correspondent in the whole of Scotland looking at these problems. So it is something which is bad, and I'm afraid to say getting worse. And we should, as Brits, worry about this. We should worry about Wales. Some of the public service story in Wales are absolutely shocking, and yet because of devolution, the rest of the UK stopped caring about it.
James, you talk about the rise of UKIP in Wales. I mean, what's going on there, and shouldn't that be of interest to us?
Yeah, no, I think one of the reasons that UKIP is doing well in Wales is that UKIP has a large amount of, to use the phrase, left behind voters. Voters who don't feel that the modern economy, globalisation and technology are working for them. And I think this is one of the things which is we don't know enough about what is going on in our own country. And I think that this is a big problem. I think that, you know, that devolution was meant to deal with the fact that this is a London-centric society. Has actually made that problem even worse, because London now thinks, oh, we don't need to know about this or that. There is an extent to which people are just unaware of what is happening there. You know, I bet you if I stopped a random Tory MP and asked them who the First Minister of Wales was, there would be a look of panic on their face that wouldn't exist if I asked them who the Speaker of the House of Representatives was, for example.
I mean, James jokes, but Ed Miliband was asked to name the leaders of the Scottish Labour Party contest, and he couldn't. This was the party of which he was then a leader of the Scottish Labour Party. So it is situation where the cabinet and the shadow cabinet almost all say, in both cases, they probably know more about the south of France than they know about Scotland.
But it's not as if there's a huge amount of interest in the London elections either.
This is one of the shocking things when you think about this. Turnout in London last time around, with Boris and Ken on the ballot, lots of national media attention because Boris was a big national figure already by that stage, and the London Olympics coming up, turnout then was 38%. which does make me wonder how low turnout is going to be this time around. I was just reflecting that on my walk to work this time 4 years ago, I passed a bunch of kind of Ken posters or stickers. I think I've seen one thing for Sadiq Khan, and we're a week and a day away from the vote. There just does seem to be a complete lack of interest. And I think this is even worse when it comes to police and crime commissioners election, which are happening kind of all across England and Wales, apart from London and Manchester. There, that seems to have gone completely beneath the radar. I mean, the government hasn't even bothered to send out details to voters of who's standing. I mean, it is quite remarkable the lack of interest in these elections. And I do think the words democratic crisis and all that, they're overused and overwrought. But here, the level of turnout is, I think, potentially very alarming.
It's important to remember that these police and crime commissioners were David Cameron's great hope when he came to office. Oh, this is going to be brilliant. We're going to revitalise local democracy. They'll be able to choose these local heroes. And this is the theory, but it never works out in practice. Now, all of this, I think, matters because we can look now. We've had quite a long time of devolution, 17 years in Scotland and Wales, and you cannot point to any improvement in public services. I think that's been disproven. We've seen the same with the police and crime commissioners. Nobody cares about them. You can't point to hardly any examples.
And I don't think they've solved the fundamental accountability problem. This is what police and crime commissioners were meant to do is, if you were really knocked that you thought that your local police force were spending their time catching people speeding on an empty road at 11 o'clock at night rather than dealing with burglary or some other more serious crime, you vote for a police and crime commissioner who would set the priorities of what the force would be, and that's what would. I don't think anyone thinks that has happened. I don't think you turned up to people in Sussex and said, how has policing changed because of your police and crime commissioner? They could give you an answer.
It doesn't work, but it's going to get even worse in that the government's pursuing even more devolution. This English is going to give you even more powers to local authorities with no evidence at all that it's going to make things better or more accountable.
And one of the things that's particularly worrying, as Fraser says, is this is happening at the same time that local news media is in crisis. So the precisely the people who actually you need to kind of act as the watchdogs to make sure that the voters have enough information to hold these people to account are going.
I suppose everyone's more focused on America.
It's show business. You know, the Donald Trump phenomenon is an entertainment one. It's more entertaining than the characters in Welsh politics. So, and there really is one character in Scottish politics, really, and that's Nicola Sturgeon. That is part of the problem. Now, of course, it's our job as journalists to try to come up with good stories to make people more interested in what's happening. But we do see in this complete lack of interest in all of these devolved elections the way in which devolution is serving to loosen the ties that ought to be binding us together as a country.
And finally, James, do you think it just shows that there's less of an appetite for local democracy than was perhaps thought?
I think the Police and Crime Commissioner experiment is actually a kind of bit of a rebuke to those people like myself who thought, you know, the answer is clearer lines of accountability, put the public in charge, allow them to vote for people, and you'll get a better form of governance. I think that does require the public to believe that these people have some power and that they can make a difference. And in the case of police and crime commissioners, sadly, people don't seem to have been persuaded of that. Indeed, if you look at how they've been rolled into these elected mayors, I don't think there'll be many police and crime commissioners left in a decade's time.
The question is how much appetite there was in the first place. I mean, when David Cameron had these local referenda asking people in Liverpool and Manchester they wanted mayors, they voted no. They said, no, we don't want this extra devolution. And now they find out that was the wrong answer and they're getting these mayors anyway. So what they've whetted is a non-appetite. People don't want the extra layers of government because the people sense what the politicians are only getting to find out, that it simply doesn't work.
And finally, can books kill? That's the question Emily Rhodes asks in the magazine this week. She says that if we claim books can be a force for good, then we must also accept that they can do harm. But is that really the case? Or are we underestimating books at our peril? I'm joined by Emily Rhodes to discuss. So Emily, how dangerous can books actually be?
Well, when I thought about books actually killing, the example that came to mind, perhaps not entirely convincingly, I suppose, is the fictional one in Howard's End, where right at the climax towards the end, Leonard Bast, who throughout has seen books as his salvation, he's described as on the brink of this abyss of poverty, and he's always reading these books to try and improve himself. He sort of sits down and reads Ruskin in the evenings, is actually killed by books. A bookcase falls on him, and Forster describes the shower of books that kind of crushes him. It does make you think, why was Forster saying books can kill you when they're so often a symbol of improvement and hope? Here they're actually shown to be treacherous. So I even did some thinking about real life examples. And I suppose there's this idea that books are such dangerous objects, they're so powerful, that power can be a great thing. But what if it's American Psycho, which in Australia can only be sold shrink-wrapped to over-18s? Or Anthony Burgess, who wrote Clockwork Orange, described himself as belonging to the ranks of the menacing when talking about this kind of cult of violence that art can help cultivate. So I think there is this real danger in books.
I mean, you mentioned American Psycho, which is still obviously kind of gruesome to read, but there are now plenty of films and computer games which sort of go far beyond what Patrick Bateman gets up to in that book. Do you think this is specifically to do with books, or do you think kind of ideas and, you know, films can also have similar effects?
Absolutely. I think often films and games are based on books. A Clockwork Orange is actually quite a good example because it only really became such a success after the film. But I suppose the seeds are in the original book. And maybe there's something about the fact that when you read a book, it's such a private act. You know, you read it on your own. You're not with loads of other people in this sort of group setting. And perhaps the power of those words when they're just consumed personally like that, maybe there's more in that.
I suppose sort of private nature of it, I suppose you could also argue that it's a private place to contemplate these ideas and not necessarily act on them, but consider them. And actually in that respect, books, even if the ideas are dangerous, the kind of exploration of them in books isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Perhaps. I'd also argue that maybe, yes, you take them in this intense personal way and consider them, but maybe they also seep in and affect you in a more powerful, almost subconscious way. And then it could sort of come out at a later stage without you really realising.
And I mean, in the US at the moment, there's a lot of discussion about the idea that we should have trigger warnings on books which might have controversial or dangerous ideas within them. Do you think that's something we need to think about?
I'd almost say it's pointless to put a trigger warning on a book, because the thing about books is that every single book is dangerous. Yes, there are books that are violent that can be particularly dangerous in that way, but even something so innocuous can be quite dangerous. I thought with Pride and Prejudice, you're not really supposed to empathise and like Lydia Bennett, but I love her. You know, she has all the fun. So I think you can't really put a warning on every single book. I think you just have to accept the fact that books are powerful, that power can be a force for good, but it can also be a dangerous thing, and we shouldn't underestimate them.
Sounds more like you think that books are powerful rather than necessarily all dangerous.
So is that power is necessarily dangerous in a way, isn't it? And just the very nature of reading and empathising with these other characters and slightly entering into their lives, envying those lives. If those lives aren't the lives which we're supposed to live, we're all supposed to want to be Elizabeth Bennet, not Lydia Bennet, then there is a danger in that, in wanting to be Lydia Bennet in spite of being told you should be Elizabeth Bennet.
Isn't that partly the author telling us who we want to be rather than, and no one else is telling us that? That's just a private experience of reading it.
Yes, perhaps it is partly the author. I think it's also partly certain things that society expects and dictates that can be reflected in books. Yes, but books are powerful, and I think there is a danger in that power. I think there's so much that talks about the goodness of this power. I think we've just got to keep in mind that dangerous flip side as well.
That's all for this week. You can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And a reminder that podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22. Just go to spectator.co.uk/22. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.